going to have a phenomenal tax reform.
It doesn't appear to be smooth sailing for tax cuts. Is the Republican Party as divided on tax reform as it is on health care reform?
Oh, that's a tough question. Right now, yes, possibly.
The Democrats have now become the party of no. As I hope we have middle class tax cuts. Nothing for rich people. That's something that Democrats should rejoice of.
I think everything's up in the air now.
Everything is up in the air because the Republicans in the House have not passed the $1 trillion tax cut, the mother of all tax cuts, that is getting rid of Obamacare.
Healthcare is going to happen at some point. Now, if it doesn't happen fast enough, I'll start the taxes. But the tax reform and the tax cuts are better if I can do healthcare first.
We have lousy wage growth. We have people that are hurting in this country. We're going to try something different. We're going to go back. And that's what Ronald Reagan did. And by the way, it did work.
Well, it doesn't sound like anything's working right now. I mean, just to use your own words, you're saying at this point, if we do get something, as you said, it's going to suck.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Stocks having a difficult week in the markets this week. I call it suffering from hopioids. All those anticipated changes coming in Washington, whether it's tax cuts or regulatory reform or spending, are fading in the distance. Looks like healthcare is back on the agenda, so the market is questioning whether economic growth is sustainable going forward. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Jonathan Krinsky from MKM Partners will be joining us. He's saying he's keeping a lookout at the small cap index. It's been consolidating recently, and he's also looking at the bond market as bond yields drop this week. As concerns over the economy rose, but he said we are transitioning from a bull market in bonds to a bear market. He still believes that this stock market is heading higher. He'll be joining me in Hour 1 along with Robert Rapier. And Rapier says, hold on, those production cuts from OPEC are starting to have effect as inventories are starting to be drawn down in the Caribbean islands. And OPEC has a strong incentive to keep oil prices now with the new target of $60 as Saudi Arabia plans to go public with Aramco, the biggest IPO in history. Higher oil prices are ahead of us. That's coming up in Hour 1, and I'll be joining John as we discuss this week's market movers.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, the U.S. economy is made up of 70% consumption, and that means you and I. We're the ones who consume various things, and directly related to that is what is happening with credit in the United States. One of the reasons we talk so much about the Fed is because the Fed adjusts the price of credit, which affects how easy it is to get money, which affects how fast we consume things. So now the question is, are the credit markets actually signaling trouble ahead? And that's a very, very important topic because typically when trouble comes, it tends to hit the bond and credit markets first. They're almost like indicators of other things to come. You know, if we had to compare the beginning of the presidency of Donald Trump to any other president, with whom would it be? At least in recent time, it would probably be George Herbert Walker Bush, because both of these presidents have begun their terms of office in a time of rising interest rates and where the business cycle is late. And as a result of that, if we look at Bush 1, he didn't get reelected. He was a one-term president. It's surprising how much what happens in the market affects the elections. And then the question is, what will that predict for Donald Trump unless he gets very, very creative at managing certain aspects of the economy and elsewhere? All of that will be the subject of conversation on The Big Picture today, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, down to the market wrap. Ryan Poplava's out this week. Jim Poplava sitting in for that. And as you started out by saying, Jim, it's a little uncertain in the markets this week, sort of a rough week.
Yeah, I call this the case of hopioids, because with the election of Donald Trump, we have had this strong stock market rally that began the day after the election with the markets across the board hitting new records and up double digits. Now, a lot of that was based on hope, based on tax reform coming with lower corporate taxes, lower individual income taxes, infrastructure spending to the tune of $1 trillion, and then, of course, deregulation and the repeal of Obamacare. Well, there was a big major setback on the legislative front when The Republicans were unable to get and muster enough votes to move a repeal of Obamacare through the House. And so now we've gone back and forth. The president said, well, we're going to move on to tax reform. And then the market responded. The market went up. Well, now it's back to health care reform, because actually the two are linked. You need the tax savings with health care reform because it is just eating up gobs of money in Medicare and government spending. You need those savings and you need to fix the problem because Obamacare is collapsing. More insurance companies are pulling out of exchanges. And as many consumers have seen this year, premiums across the country have gone up an average of 25%. If you make over $85,000 on Medicare, you've seen your premiums go up as much as 22%. So, John, I would say that a lot of this hope that this would get done, this guy is an action president, that he would get these things done, and now hope is starting to fade that these things will actually get through the legislature this year. It's not only that the president is having problems, the Democrats plan to oppose anything that President Trump proposes, but the president is having trouble within his own party itself.
So this would seem to boil down to, I mean, what, weak prices? And I guess the supposition here is that the market is beginning to realize that all of this stuff, whether we talk about tax reform or Obamacare reform, it's not going to happen very quickly. There's going to be a protracted battle here. And so the market's been riding on all this euphoria. Now they may be waking up to the fact that there's going to be a little time in coming here.
It's even bigger than that, because we've had weakening economic numbers. We saw weak GDP growth in the fourth quarter of last year, and it's looking like first quarter economic growth is also weak. And it's not off to a great start for the second quarter. We had the weak employment numbers that came out last Friday. Now we have two back-to-back monthly numbers on retail sales. They are weakening. And then one that is a big red flag out there, we talked about this last week on the program, is auto sales are starting to decline along with mortgage applications. So you're talking about two sectors of the economy, housing and autos. Those are two big sectors. They're weakening. And now retail sales are weakening. So on top of that, you have a Federal Reserve with Janet Yellen this week coming out on Monday saying the days of easy money are over. So the market's trying to figure out, wait a minute, the Fed is raising interest rates, which we know eventually will harm the economy because it'll make it more expensive to borrow. But there was a hope, once again, going back to the opioids, that the tax cuts, the infrastructure spending would be strong enough to offset any weakening in the economy caused by a raise in interest rates. And there, apparently, if you listen to all the Fed officials, despite the weakening economic numbers that we keep seeing coming out each month, whether it's employment, whether it's retail, whether it's auto sales, whether it's housing, there was hope that tax cuts would be offset. And the Fed, despite these weakening numbers, have given no indication that they tend to soften their stance of the progression of raising interest rates. I mean, they raised interest rates in December. They raised them in March. And right now, the futures market saying there's a 50% chance of raising them in June. Now, a lot of this is based on, I believe one of the reasons the Fed went in March of this year is we had such a strong stock market. If this stock market were to start rolling over, or we went through a 5 or 10% correction, watch how quickly these Fed governors would change their tune. But right now, there is a worry over economic growth. And it's also being reflected in the way investors are investing their money. There's been a record amount of bond issuance, which we'll get into the big picture, and we'll talk about what's going on in the credit markets, but also bond yields are dropping. And when you have bond yields are dropping, they're dropping because they're basically raising a question of whether we're going to have this strong economic growth that the markets were rallying on. Now, remember, right after the election, bond yields rose in the 10-year note got up to 2.6% along with the stock market. So bond prices were going down, stock prices were going up. Both those two markets were factoring in two different economic scenarios. The bond yields were going up because they were thinking that we were going to have faster economic growth. That was going to lead to higher inflation. So you saw a spike in bond yields after the election. Stock prices were rising to record levels based on the anticipation the tax cuts, the infrastructure spending, the deregulation would produce stronger economic growth. Remember, throughout the campaign, the president says we're going to get economic growth of 3 or 4%. Well, what do we have now? Is what I call reality is starting to set in. We haven't seen anything done on the legislative front. What was proposed, you know, the Republicans themselves weren't able to get that through the legislature. So now the bond market and the stock market are taking almost similar approaches. The bond market is saying, look, we don't think we're going to see this economic growth. So you're starting to see bond yields drop. You're starting to see a large amount of money has been moving into the bond market along with record amounts of bond issuance. In fact, we set some records in the first quarter. And you're also seeing M&A activity begin to slow down. So if there was one positive piece of news this week, John, it was the IMF is very upbeat on global growth.
So what is the significance of that?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the rising dollar, which has been rising as a result of rising interest rates. Well, the Fed raised interest rates in March. Instead of the dollar going up, the dollar actually went down. And we'll talk about this here in a second as to why the gold market is a big beneficiary of this, along with oil prices. But as economic growth picks up overseas, that tends to weaken the dollar. The dollar was strong for a number of reasons. Interest rates were higher here. Economic growth was better here. Well, now the IMF is saying economic growth is starting to pick up in Europe. It's starting to pick up in Asia, China, and Japan. So stronger economic growth actually weakens the dollar. So there's been a weakening in the dollar. And we'll talk about here some of the big winners this week, which have been commodities in bonds. But there was also some geopolitical risk. The week before, we had the cruise missile strike on Syria. And this week, we had that dropping of that Moab, or the mother of all bombs, in Afghanistan. So what we have is fading confidence about economic reforms being put in place that would be strong enough to offset an aging business cycle and a rate raising cycle by the Fed.
Well, then overall, who were the winners and losers from this week?
I would say the big winners this week were commodities. A falling dollar, we saw the price of gold hit $1,290 on this Friday. Silver prices got up to $1,855. And crude oil prices are back up over $50 a barrel. So precious metals, oil, bonds, and utilities were the big winners this week as the risk-off trade pushed 10-year bond yields down to less than 2.25%. In fact, the utility average was the only average this week that was on the positive side.
And the big things to watch in the weeks upcoming?
I would say probably the two things. We have corporate earnings. We're going to be full steam in corporate earnings beginning next week. So investors are going to want to see if we see those jump in earnings. There's two sectors that should be the stellar performers in Q1, and that would be energy and also the financials, as we'll be speaking with Robert Rapier here in the first hour. He sees higher oil prices and the possibility of oil hitting 60. So we're going to be looking at corporate earnings, but also we're going to be following some of these economic numbers because we're getting into Q2, and Q2 is normally the strongest quarter of the year. And right now, we've got weak employment number, but that's only 1 month. So we'll want to see if that trend continues. But we do have several months of falling retail sales, falling auto sales, and falling mortgage applications. And above all, a sharp drop in commercial and industrial loans. And the big conundrum, and we'll talk about this in the big picture, is credit is starting to tighten and slow down. And we'll talk about the implications for that on the economy. So economic numbers and earnings in the weeks ahead. And of course, we'll be looking to see what the Fed is going to do despite these falling and weakening economic numbers. All the Fed governors, including Yellen this week, coming out and saying, hey, the days of easy money are over. The Fed is hell-bent on raising interest rates and shrinking their balance sheet. We'll have to see politically if Washington can do something to offset that. All of that in the weeks ahead.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The yield curve is a phenomenal indicator of the state of health of an economy. And it's a little bit misunderstood, I feel, by most people. A lot of people, when they talk about the interest rates in an economy and, you know, the Fed raising or lowering interest rates, people tend to simplify and think that, you know, okay, well, all interest rates move up at the same time and all interest rates down at the same time. That's really not the case. And the yield curve provides a perfect example of this dynamic at play. And it has done a great job at predicting recession. In terms of our analysis, that's one of those dominant data points that we oftentimes always refer to.
Well, for the last couple of weeks, stocks have been going sideways. Is the market over or just taking a break? Joining us on the program is Jonathan Krinsky. Jonathan, let's start with one of the old technical theories, and that's the Dow theory on the stock market. We've got industrials hitting a new high, and then over the last couple of weeks going sideways. But the transports have been going sideways since December of last year. What's going on here, and is this relevant?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Anytime you see weakness in the transports, there it's certainly a bit of a concern. As far as it relates to kind of the Dow theory, remember the Dow theory remains on a buy signal until you get a sell signal. Now, when you have one that makes a new high and the other doesn't, and you're still on a buy signal, that's a non-confirmation. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's a sell signal. And I believe that actually both the transports and the industrials did actually make a new high at the end of February, early March. So I don't even believe there's a non-confirmation at this point. Now, the rollover, the weakness, from our perspective, it's still within the confines of kind of a consolidation. We have to remember we saw an amazing surge following the election, and it still hasn't even given up, say, maybe even half of those gains. So from our perspective, it's still within the confines of a consolidation. You need to see a lot more weakness before we would consider thinking that there was any type of serious top on either of those indices.
Let's go to another series of indexes, the Russell, the mid-cap, S&P 500. Seems like they've been going sideways since December 2. Does that say anything about the markets up until that time, especially following the election? We had a real sharp jump in the Russell 2000 to a record level. And then all of a sudden, at the end of or the beginning of the December, it just kind of stopped and went sideways.
Yeah, so again, if you take a step back, following the election, the small caps and the mid caps broke out of really, they really hadn't done anything since the beginning of 2014. So they broke out of a multi-year base, pretty much in a straight line. And then, as you mentioned, since early December, they haven't done much. So we know that markets correct one of two ways, either through time or through price. So even though they've been underperforming, we would say that the action since early December is really just a time consolidation. Now, if they were to weaken further and get back below the prior highs from 2014, 2015, again, prior resistance often acts as support. So if they were to break below that newfound support level, that would be a sign that maybe the move post-election was more of a blow-off or final high. But I think at this point, it's premature to say that. We just think it's working off those extreme overbought conditions through time. You know, now you have the case where the Russell has been in a pretty narrow range for the past 5 months. So if that were to actually resolve to the upside, which actually I think at this point we hear less people talking about, that would be kind of interesting, and that could be a setup for later this year. But I think at this point it's just it's certainly worth watching. Nobody really feels great when small caps are underperforming. They tend to be the more risky or higher beta group as opposed to the large caps, and oftentimes at major tops you will see small cap stocks start to weaken ahead of large cap stocks as investors kind of seek out the safety of the mega caps. But I think at this point it's premature to say that's what's happening, and you know, we'll continue to monitor it going forward.
Let's look at interest rates. As stocks took off after the election, we saw the same thing with interest rates. Interest rates rose to 2.6% or a little above that on the 10-year note. And then since then, hitting a high in December, we've been back and forth in a narrow range between 2.3 and 2.6, despite the fact the Fed raised interest rates in December. They raised them again in March. People thought the 10-year would be much higher by now. What's your take on interest rates here?
Yeah, so it's a bit disappointing to see them back down below that 230 level. That was kind of a key support from the last couple months, the trading range we've been watching. I think there's a couple things going on. One, when rates started to move back to the upside, closer to 260, you had a lot of, the market was short bonds. They were positioned for higher rates. A lot of people felt that, you know, the secular low is in for rates, and bonds are just going to be the easiest short in the world. And of course, when everyone's thinking one way, it often goes the other way. So I think part of it was positioning. You're seeing an unwind of a lot of shorts in the bond market. They're getting a bit squeezed. And then the other thing to remember is we're still in potentially, again, we don't know this, but we're in potentially a transition of a 35-year bond bull market that's potentially transitioning to a bear market. And the last time we saw that was in the 1930s, 1940s, and it took at least 10 or 15 years of kind of sideways, choppy base building before rates actually started to move sustainably higher. So, you know, it's from a short-term perspective, it's a bit concerning to see 10-year back below 230. But, you know, in the big scheme of things, if this is in fact a secular transition in rates, we shouldn't be surprised to see a lot of choppy back and forth filling before you see a sustained move higher in rates. Ultimately, I think this year, the 260, 265 level is the key level to watch. You get above that at this point, you know, that would make a pretty good argument that, you know, we're heading well north of 3%. But, yeah, I would say in the near term, it's been a bit frustrating for those expecting higher rates.
All right, let's move to another market, the U.S. dollar, and let's talk about the dollar and gold. The president has come out on several occasions saying that he doesn't like a strong dollar, obviously, knowing that that impacts trade imbalances and affects imports and exports. Let's talk about the dollar here.
Yeah, so the dollar, I do think, is still in, despite those comments, I think it is still in a primary uptrend. The 100 level on the dollar index is obviously a key, not just psychological area, but that was resistance in 2014-15. It's kind of acting as support here. So I think we can move higher on the dollar. And then the nice thing about currencies, of course, is everything is relative. So if we look at some of the other major currencies against the dollar, that may give us better insight. So the euro is the biggest weighting in the dollar index. You know, to us, that still looks like it's in a major bear market against the dollar. So you have about 60% of the dollar index is the euro. So if the euro moves lower, that's going to push the dollar higher. Some of the other crosses, the yen is not quite as weak. Obviously, it's been strengthening. So that's, I would say, more of a neutral call there. But some of the other currencies, the Canadian dollar, Aussie dollar, all to us, they're still vulnerable against the U.S. So you add it all up, you know, maybe a bit of more consolidation, but ultimately, we still think the dollar moves higher from here.
And as you take a look at this, there's been a movement. Let's say we've seen bond yields come down. We've seen utilities do well. Is this part of the ro-ro trade? Are we back to risk-off trade, or is this just temporary?
You know, it's what's remarkable about the market in the last, I would say since the indices kind of peaked in, well, for the most part, last December, some of them did make new highs, but last few months, it's been a constant rotation among the different sectors. You know, technology has clearly been a leadership group. Energy has been kind of a laggard, but there's really not one sector that's sustainably been a massive outperformer or underperformer. And every week, it seems there's a new rotation. So that's really the hallmark of bull markets and what keeps it alive. If we were to stop seeing money go into technology and just sustain, if we saw sustained move into some of the more defensive groups like staples and utilities and REITs, that would probably be a sign of more weakness for the medium term. But we just haven't seen enough of that to really think it's anything more than kind of this consolidation or rotation theme.
Yeah, sometimes we generally see as you come towards an end of a bull market or even an economic cycle, you see energy and commodities start to outperform, but also you start to see consumer staples. And it doesn't seem like we're seeing that, although energy stocks have certainly improved here.
Yeah, again, I think some of the classic business cycle groups and rotations that we're kind of used to seeing or kind of have seen in prior cycles aren't necessarily holding. And I don't know, part of that could be just because interest rates are so low for so long. Part of it could be just because information is processed faster. And these, as I mentioned, these rotations among sectors and the advent of ETFs makes it easier for investors to rotate very quickly. So all of this could be impacting it. But, you know, I think some of the traditional sector rotations that we're used to seeing at certain parts of the cycles are not necessarily happening right now. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, that's why we don't want to make too much predictions or forecasts based on what traditionally has happened. We kind of want to focus on what is happening right now. And we go back to just looking at traditional breadth metrics. So if we look at the percentage of stocks above the 200-day moving average, we still have about 70% of all U.S. stocks above their 200-day. Prior to major corrections, you tend to see that reading under 60%. That can often persist for weeks, if not months, before the index is finally cracked. So if you go back to the summer of 2015, we had under 60% of stocks above their 200-day for most of June and July, and then the indexes didn't crack until August. So, you know, we continue to keep an eye on breadth. I think it's still in a decent position, despite the fact that there has been some weakness in some of the areas you mentioned, small caps and financials, et cetera.
Now, what about international? Because right now, you've had, since November, you've had rising U.S. stock prices at record levels, but also, for the first time, we are seeing most of the markets around the globe rise as well, especially in the international markets.
Yeah, so remember, international stocks have underperformed U.S. stocks prior to this year for, I believe, the last 8 years in a row. There tends to be an inflection after 7 or 8 years if you look at the past, I guess, 20 or 30 years. So we think that international can continue to outperform the U.S. If you look, particularly Europe continues to act very well. And even emerging market stocks, since the election, have actually done very well, which probably would surprise some people, given some of the strength in the U.S. dollar. So, yeah, we think international plays catch up to the U.S. on the upside, and maybe that's where the convergence comes, not necessarily that U.S. stocks pull back, maybe U.S. stocks move around sideways, and some of the international stocks that have lagged for so long play catch up. And remember, emerging markets have been essentially sideways for the last 6 or 7 years. So, and that's as the U.S. has had an amazing bull market. So I don't think it would be surprising to see U.S. stocks maybe chop around a little bit more, but some of the international stocks could certainly have some catch up to the upside.
So as you look at these markets, Jonathan, a bigger picture view, I mean, if you take a look at the S&P 500, it peaked in March of 2000. We went through a two-year bear market, then it rose again for another 5 years, peaked again in 2007. And it wasn't until somewhere around 2013 that we finally exceeded the previous highs in the S&P 500. Is this a new grand secular market, or is this cyclical?
Well, that's a great point, and a lot of people just assume that the bull market is 8 years old now because they're using the March 2009 lows. But if you think about, yeah, from a secular perspective, the breakout in 2013, a lot of people would say that's the start of a new bull market. And then you could also argue that from 2015 to early 2016, even though the S&P was only in 14%, there was a significant amount of damage below the surface. Small caps were in 26%. And then if you go sector by sector, there was a lot of sectors that sold off more than 20%. So there's a lot of different ways to look at it. I think when you take a step back and look at the big picture, some of the big long-term moving averages, they're still firmly rising. So it's very difficult to make the case that we're at any type of major top. It always could be, but when, you know, I think given that the primary trends are still up, the onus is on the bears at this point to kind of prove that this is something more than just a consolidation. I'll also highlight, and this is maybe just an interesting little stat, but you mentioned the peak in March of 2000, and so far the S&P has made its high in March of this year. Aside from March of 2000, there's only one other year where the market made its year-to-date high in the month of March. I believe that was 1937, but anyway, it's very unusual for markets to make their peak in March. Generally, if they do make a high in March, they tend to see a higher high later in the year. So just keep that in the back of your mind for what it's worth.
And so as you look at this market, if and you believe we're not close to a market top at this point, what would you expect to see, or what would you be looking for if we were close to a market top? What would you expect to see in the charts?
Well, again, first of all, you need to see much more deterioration on the stock level, something, you know, on the percentage of stocks, as we mentioned, above the 200-day moving average would sustain below 60% for more than a couple weeks. And on the index level, you would really need to see something like the 200-day moving average start to flatten out and really start to roll over. So we're a long ways away from that. Again, remember, even back in March of 2000, it took many, many months of chopping and seeing some of the secondary stocks break down before the index actually finally rolled over. So it always could be, but you know, we need to see a lot more deterioration below the surface before we would think that we're at a major inflection point.
And finally, a couple questions. What looks good to you right now? And secondly, given this kind of sideways consolidation or correction that we're going through now, what would you be doing if you had money to put to work?
Well, I think technology remains the leadership group. So if you're there, I would stay there. I think on the stock level, there's certainly plenty of strong charts in technology. I think from a tactical perspective, financials could be interesting here. Remember, they were very loved following the election, perhaps too much so. They've certainly pulled back, but they're still in a very strong uptrend. Relative to the S&P, the underperformance we've seen over the last couple of months has just come back to kind of the breakout level on a relative basis. So financials could be interesting here from a tactical perspective. And there's still a lot of strong charts in some of the consumer areas. The home builders still look great. So there's a lot of broad-based good trends out there. And then keep an eye on the small caps. If they do kind of get above this recent consolidation, that's a very powerful base from which they can potentially move higher. We're not saying they will, but that's certainly an area to keep an eye on.
All right. Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Best way would probably be on Twitter. It's at JKrinskyMKM.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program. We were talking about the bracketing before. If we have to look at a group that's particularly at risk or vulnerable, which group would you say that is?
Well, obviously, older Americans, because as you live longer, you're facing higher medical expenses. We're seeing this with Obamacare, where Medicare premiums, if you make a certain level of income, went up 22% this year. And they're talking about raising Medicare premiums even further. So older Americans, minorities, unmarried Americans, and especially single women and less educated seniors are most vulnerable to retirement. A lot of that has to do with lower income. So if you are well educated, there's less of a risk. If you are lower educated, that means you didn't have as much income during your working career, so you haven't saved, or you probably didn't participate in a pension plan. So those are the most vulnerable people in retirement. And it's something, John, that wealth disparity is increasing as a result of education, as a result of race, and as a result of age. So these are three factors. Well, inflation prices have been heating up. But lately, they've been coming down over the last month, many economists saying these are the tailing effects of the rise in energy last year. After hitting a bottom at the beginning of the year, the price of oil doubled. But what about oil prices going forward? Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. And Robert, let's talk about the OPEC cuts that were put into effect, and it looks like compliance has been pretty good. And that was to reduce production by, let's say, 1.2 million barrels. The IEA just reported that inventories globally went up marginally in the first quarter. Let's talk about the cuts by OPEC versus, let's say, the increase in shale production in the U.S. and its impact on oil.
Yeah, so far, you know, the cuts, the agreement between OPEC and with the non-OPEC members was a total of 1.8 million barrels. Within OPEC alone, it was like 1.2. And then they got a 300,000 agreement from Russia and then some other oil producers, and altogether it's 1.8. You figure they are probably at 1.5 because not everybody's complying, or, you know, somewhere in that ballpark. The increase in shale production actually started before OPEC announced the cuts. It turned upwards, I think, in October. And I believe we're 300,000 or 400,000 barrels a day off the lows. I haven't checked that this morning, but you know, the fear is that if that keeps on at that rate, and I did the math on this for an article for Forbes a couple of months ago, that by the end of this year or early next year, that the U.S. could have totally offset those cuts. Now, the other side of the equation is we continue to grow demand globally at 1 to 1.5 million barrels a day every year. So it's looking like, and the IEA thinks, that the market is coming into balance and that we will actually start to pull inventories down here pretty quickly. Inventories are coming down offshore. You know, there was a lot of floating storage, and that is starting to dissipate. It's starting to come onshore into the U.S., and that's created a little bit of a confusing situation where our inventories in the U.S. are very, very high, and yet we continue to import a lot of oil. And that's a lot of that floating storage coming onshore in the U.S. where it's fairly cheap to store oil.
Yeah, I want to talk about those islands in the Caribbean where they have huge oil storage facilities, and those inventory levels are starting to come down. Let's talk about the significance of that, because Caribbean oil storage is starting to drop as traders unload this oil and bring it into the market. What is that telling us?
Yeah, I mean, it's telling you that OPEC's cuts are working, that some of the places that are not immediately obvious, you know, the IEA numbers for all of, you know, the OECD members, it's pretty clear that storage hasn't dramatically come down yet, but the marginal storage, like in the Caribbean islands and the floating storage, those are starting to come down by quite a lot at this point. And I think you'll see, as that storage starts to deplete, you will see it start to deplete at some of the onshore, some of the major country storage, especially the U.S. You know, the U.S. storage, it affects oil prices in a way that probably it shouldn't. You know, globally, you know, oil storage levels are flat or coming down. In the U.S., you know, a month or 6 weeks ago, we had an unexpected jump in crude oil. And I wrote an article then explaining that that's because we're going into refinery maintenance season. And if you looked at the big picture, the finished product inventories actually declined more than oil inventories increased. But that helped take us down below $50 oil, and we stayed there for a while. And it's really, it has a disproportionate impact on the oil markets that it shouldn't.
You know, there was an article on Bloomberg this week that said that Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Kuwait are aiming for $60 oil, and these are some of the biggest producers within OPEC. Originally, they were targeting $55 a barrel, and on this Friday, when we're doing the interview, Brent is over 55, and you've got WTI, it's over 53. So how realistic is this? Because, for example, Saudi Arabia has a vested interest in seeing $60 oil because they're selling 5% of the state oil company Aramco, which is due to be the biggest IPO in history.
Right. It's important for Saudi that they get oil up to $60. And, you know, they have the influence to be able to do it. They will meet next month. I think you will see them come out of that meeting and extend the cuts they decided on last November. And I think we've got a pretty good shot coming out of that meeting to see, you know, a little bit of a bump in oil prices. And I think we've got a realistic shot of seeing $60 in the second half of the year.
You know, the surprising thing, and let's talk about the oil companies, at least the Western oil companies. You know, one of the worst performing sectors last year has been the oil stocks at the beginning of the year, but then they had a nice run as the price of oil lifted to over $50 a barrel. But lately, there's been a lot of weakness. And the thing that really strikes me about this, Robert, is last year, if you looked at company earnings, and especially the first half of the year, they looked dismal because the price of oil got down to $26 a barrel. Now we're over $50 a barrel. And if there's one sector within the S&P that's due to produce stellar earnings this year, it's the energy sector. Yet it's been lagging.
Yeah, and I think part of that, I think it's a pretty well-kept secret that energy was the S&P 500's top-performing sector last year. You know, if you look at all the select sector spider funds that are based on all the different sectors in the S&P 500, energy returned, the XLE returned 28% last year. The only other thing that was above 20 were the financials. And a lot of that was, as you say, the year started off poorly. But then as oil prices recovered, I think there was a lot of anticipation that earnings were going to recover. And so I think the slow start this year is maybe got ahead of ourselves a little bit last year in looking forward. But, you know, I do think that the energy sector right now is undervalued and is starting to become more undervalued, especially as oil prices creep up a little bit higher. Natural gas prices are quite a bit better than they were a year ago. I think we're going to see some decent earnings. And I think a lot of the good news on some of these companies, like Dakota Access Pipeline, I don't think that's priced into some of these companies that will benefit from that. And on the flip side, you know, some of Donald Trump's energy policies are going to likely hurt the ethanol sector. And you haven't seen really that sector, you know, some of the companies in that sector are actually a little bit higher than they were when he got elected. So I think there's a little bit of a disconnect there. I think there's a little bit of a disconnect in some of the oil companies and some of the midstream companies.
Yeah, because you take a look at, I don't know if you're looking at PE ratios, if you're looking at dividend yields, some of the best dividend yields out there in the market today are within the energy sector. I mean, and I'm talking about high quality companies, whether you're looking at some of the big international majors, whether you're looking at Shell, Exxon, Chevron, Total, a lot of these companies, and even BP are offering dividend yields that, my goodness, look like junk bonds.
Yeah, and the midstreams especially. You look at the midstreams and you got yields 8 to 10%, you know, with fairly good coverage ratios for these things. So, you know, that would suggest that they are undervalued. The base price is undervalued and they are due to rally. A lot of the companies you just mentioned have quite high yields and are generating the cash flow to cover those yields. BP, it's questionable whether they can maintain a 7% yield with the cash flow they're generating, but some of those other companies are certainly capable of 4 to 5% yields and, you know, pretty safe yield.
Not only are these companies cheap, but do you think it's a question of last year, as you mentioned, energy stocks were probably the best performing group within the S&P 500. Sometimes when you have a big run up, as we saw last year, beginning in the second quarter, there's a little bit of consolidation and there's a catch up period. But still, when you look at a market that is expensive as it is today, and you're looking for, okay, what can I buy that's safe, that isn't overvalued, and at least has the prospects to grow their earnings, the energy sector really stands out to me.
Yeah, you know, I think it just feels like we're still in a long bear market for energy. And I just gave a presentation last week, and I asked a question, who knows what the top performing sector was last year? And nobody really felt like it was energy, even though it was. It's just that with oil prices having been at $100 for, you know, years, at $50, people just don't feel like energy is a sexy place to be. But, you know, that's certainly the time to buy. When the market is discounting and undervaluing, that's when I like to get in. And I actually have been buying some energy stocks lately.
Likewise, I want to talk about the role that U.S. inventories play in the world, because the market is seem so obsessed with U.S. inventories. And Robert, you and I know these are estimates. They're not exactly precise. It's not like the government has dipsticks that they dip into some kind of well storage every single week to get an exact reading. A lot of these things are estimates. But why such a major role when you're talking about the largest consumer in the world is China? It's not the U.S.
Right. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that U.S. inventory should swing prices as much as they do. Demand in the U.S. is strong right now, Our production has gone up some, but the biggest thing is we continue to import a lot of oil. So, you know, if we weren't importing oil, our inventories wouldn't be so high. And so the reason our inventories are so high is because oil companies think they need to store that oil. And one of the reasons, I talked to a NASDAQ analyst a couple of weeks ago, and she said one of the reasons is people fear the possibility of a border tax adjustment coming. And so some of these refiners are starting to stockpile oil ahead of that. They're trying to avoid that tax. So that's another factor in there that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about, but she was convinced that's one of the reasons we're seeing inventories at such high levels in the U.S. You know, despite our very high imports, it would seem that if inventories were this high, at least our imports would fall off. But, you know, as long as they continue to import oil and stockpile those inventories, they've got a reason for doing it. And she believes that it was because of the possibility of the border adjustment tax.
It always amazes me that what people don't understand about the oil markets, it's not only supply and demand, but it's also there's a geopolitical factor, as we saw on Thursday with the dropping of that bomb in Afghanistan. But also you have places like Libya, which tried to restart their oil production. It's hard to believe at one time Libya was exporting 1.6 million barrels a day. They're down significantly from that. But it's like they get an oil field, start pumping oil, and a week later it's shut down because of political problems.
Right. And a few years ago, that would have had a big impact on oil prices. When 7 or 8 years ago, the global excess production capacity had shriveled up to almost nothing. And so any news like that, if a pipeline went down in Nigeria, if a field went down in Libya, it could really have a big impact on oil prices. And right now, we've got a couple of million barrels a day of excess capacity. So you see something going on like Libya, it doesn't swing the markets quite as much as it would have just a few years ago. And so that's what OPEC is trying to rectify by taking these barrels off the market. You know, if you look back what happened over the last 10 years, the shale oil boom, almost nobody saw coming. And in about 6 years, it dumped about 6 million barrels a day of oil onto the market that the world had not expected. And OPEC responded, well, at first they responded by doing nothing, but then they responded by declaring a price war with the U.S. and dumping more oil on the market. So we had 6 million barrels come onto the market. OPEC dumped another 2 onto the market. We had a very oversupplied market, and that ultimately crashed prices down to the 20s, which I don't think OPEC had ever intended for prices to go down that much. They thought that $60 oil would bankrupt a lot of the shale industry, and they found out that it wouldn't. It bankrupted some of the weaker producers, some of the more leveraged producers, but you know, what it did, it made a lot of the remaining guys much stronger. You know, they squeezed costs. They optimized the way they produce this oil. They figured out how much sand they need to use. And they really figured out, you know, they got up the learning curve on a lot of these oil fields. And so now you see $50, $60 oil, they're going to be able to survive that. And I think if OPEC had known that, they would have never gone down this path.
So as you look at these factors, you have a couple of things. You have OPEC cutting production, and it looks like they're likely to extend those production cuts into the second half of the year. You have Saudi Aramco going public, so you have some of the major players within OPEC, including Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, that want $60 oil. So you have that on one side. On the other side, you have U.S. shale production, which is up, and you take a look at the number of wells, it's not too far from where they were at the peak. And then you also have two other factors that nobody really talks about. One is growing energy demand in the world. Now, even though the IEA just cut their consumption to 1.3 million barrel increase for demand this year, that's still 1.3 million barrels, equal to almost what OPEC wants to cut. And then on top of that, you have something called depletion, which I hear nobody talking about.
Right. You know, it's a lot. And you do have the demand increase. It's just like you say. And sometimes the media will misrepresent this. If the IEA says, you know, we thought it was going to grow at 1.5, it's going to grow at 1.3. And the media will misrepresent that as weakening demand. And that's not what it is at all. This year, we will need 1.3 million barrels more than we needed a year ago. And with OPEC cutting production, and U.S. shale cannot fill the gap that's going to be left with the OPEC cuts and the increase in demand, you know, we are setting up for higher oil prices. You know, that's another thing that the NASDAQ analyst I spoke with said. She said, if you look down the road here, you know, we had a period of underinvestment over the last few years, and that's going to come home to roost in just a few years. And we're going to see shortfall, production shortfall that's not going to meet what demand is, and we're going to be back where we were probably in 2007, which is what happened then. We had a period of underinvestment and very strong demand growth, and suddenly the excess capacity in the world shriveled up, and we had $100 oil.
Let me throw one other factor here, too. All of this shale production obviously is increasing U.S. oil production, but there was also a recent story by Bloomberg that says a number of these shale oil producers are hedging their production. So how much would this hedging, along with increased production, sort of put a cap on the upper range of oil?
Yeah, it will. I don't know to what extent they're hedging. I mean, if you can make money at $50 oil, $55 oil, you're probably going to hedge at that level, at least some, especially if you're afraid that oil prices are going to go down. But if you're confident they're going to go a bit higher, you may hold off on the hedging. I know that ConocoPhillips, for one, has been criticized because they don't really hedge. They say that over time that all sort of evens out. And they said, we'd rather not pay the cost of hedging, and we'd just rather ride the market up and down. There are plenty of oil companies like that. If you bet wrong, and let's say OPEC comes in and they do decide to have a price war again, those guys that didn't hedge are going to get hurt. It's a factor, but I just don't know how big a factor. I don't know how much hedging is going on right now with WTI at, what, $53?
So as you look at this market right now, and you take a look at the stock market itself, which has gone up considerably with probably some of the highest valuations we've seen in an extended period of time. As you look at the energy sector, if you were buying, would you be buying mid-cap stocks? Would you be buying the large-cap, higher dividend-paying international companies or the smaller exploration companies?
I think right now, if I look at what's happened over the last year, you know, the energy sector soared last year, but midstream was largely left behind. So midstream sort of lagged. And midstream, I mean the pipeline companies, the infrastructure companies. If you look at the policies that Donald Trump's putting into place, it will probably help the midstream companies more than anyone. So I think they've reached a point where they are fairly undervalued. And that's where I would be putting some money. You know, I think the ethanol companies particularly are overvalued. The oil companies, it's a mix. Some of them are fairly valued. Some of them are undervalued. And then if you want to be safe, the ExxonMobil's, you know, the Chevron's, that's always a pretty safe bet. If oil prices are going to start to rise, you'll see their refining end get hurt. And you'll see the refiners get hurt. That's probably a sector that's a little bit vulnerable right now to rising oil prices. But really the midstreams, that's where I'd be looking.
Well, listen, Robert, you write extensively on the energy sector. If our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they could do so.
I write two weekly columns for Investing Daily. It's called The Energy Letter. It publishes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then I also write a subscription column for them called The Energy Strategist, where I manage a portfolio of energy companies, give specific buy and sell instructions. And I put out a regular newsletter for that service for the energy strategist, giving people overview of the market, what's going on, and, you know, what they should be buying and selling. And then I also have a weekly column with Forbes where I just cover general energy sector trends.
Don't know if you noticed it or not. Well, you couldn't help but notice if you were watching, but the market seems to be losing some of its enthusiasm. And maybe they're realizing that the euphoria they've had about tax reform and healthcare reform aren't going to happen quite as fast as they thought from the Congress. And so the enthusiasm is wearing off. Meanwhile, you know, the U.S. economy is made up of 70% consumption, and that is driven by the credit markets because people tend to buy what they can borrow to buy in many cases. For large ticket items. So the real question is, are we seeing signals of trouble ahead? Because when trouble first appears, it seems to hit the bond and credit markets first, and it acts like an indicator that worse times are coming and that a recession is on the horizon. And then we'll look at the uphill battle that President Trump is going to be fighting here with the economy. The beginning of his presidency matches the beginning of the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush. Both of them have come into office during a time of rising interest rates and an aging business cycle, and we saw that Bush 1 only had one term in office. Remember, people tend to vote their pocketbooks when they go to the poll, and they vote jobs and taxes as well. So what are all of these indicators telling us? Well, coming up next in the Big Picture, we are going to discuss that as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.